But yeah, Emilio asked if I wouldn't mind doing the radio thing, and I my 2020 thing is to not say no to things.
Yeah.
And
so, okay. Oh wow, that's a good.
Hence end, why he's here.
Yeah. No.
Exactly. Damn, I wish we got that.
All right, this will be good.
What's up?
Are we starting?
We're good.
We're all going.
Right. I guess we're going.
Hello, everybody. How are you? Welcome back to the show, Last Exit of Brooklyn. My name's Tom McCaffrey. I'm here with
Eric Bronstein.
Guys.
Yeah.
Yeah, Alex Pescara. Hey, guys.
We have a guest. all right, I'm going to spoil it. It's Kristen Finnegan. Thank you so much for being here.
Why, thank you, fellas.
All right, cool. That was good. We'll wrap it up.
Sounds good. And I feel like
we run a tight ship here. So I feel like we're on American Idol. Like we're
it is, yeah. It's strange that we're all faced in the same direction right now.
These are very good audio bits, because we're all facing the same way to the producer. So let's get right into it. So we met. I think it was around 2002.
That makes sense.
Yeah,
that makes sense.
Probably around, have to check your diary.
Yeah, when you were definitely, were you blonde then, or you weren't blonde quite yet?
I was in and out of blonde. I still kind of am.
Yeah.
I had been living in L.A. for 2 years. I'd started comedy there, and then I moved back here.
Oh,
then,
yeah. I think I always had thought of you as an L.A. comic, and then I was surprised when I found out that you were from here.
Yeah, I think there was a lot of that going around. But then I met you at this place, the Parkside Lounge,
indeed,
which is like they had an open mic there. That was actually like a really good show called The Train Wreck with Joey Gay.
Damian San Marco.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And it was, and I remember when I would first go there, Ed Helms, like good people came out of there.
Yeah,
and stuff.
For sure. Yeah, I mean, there was, you know, a lot of noteworthy people kind of passing through at the time. Yeah, I knew Ed a little bit. Around that time, I was in a sketch group, or before, not actually, I think I'd stopped by then, but in Ed Helms was in a rival sketch group.
Uh-oh.
And so I knew him from that world.
That would explain all the fights you guys used to get into at the Parkside.
Constantly.
All those stabbings.
You know, you can buy and sell me.
Actually, I just saw someone who was, you were in it, was it Bob Juergens?
Bob Juergens.
And
John
Corbett.
Yes,
yeah, I just saw Bob
Juergens.
Not
the Sex and the City John Corbett, a different John Corbett.
Right, this John Corbett is J-O-N, right?
Yes,
actually.
Yes. And where did you see Bob Juergens?
I saw him at John Viner's house.
Oh,
John Viner has an apartment right down the street from me. But he's usually in L.A. He's the guy we had on who was the Family Guy producer.
Oh, yeah, he was great.
He was on the show, about 2 months ago. So I saw him there, and I'd met Bob Juergens. I hadn't seen Bob Juergens since that time, like Surf Reality.
You hear things. We were friends, you know, we're still friendly, certainly. If I bumped into him on the street, we'd have a nice conversation. But I think I heard he went QAnon.
Oh, really?
Wow. I think so. Or like one of those conspiracies. I don't know, like maybe Pizzagate or something.
I think there was some of that going. There was some of that discussed, actually.
A lot of comedians were lost.
Where John Viner was like, don't bring it up. Don't talk about it. He's like, no.
Yeah.
And then he told me that he said that you guys had done a sketch that P.T. Anderson stole. Do you remember that?
What?
He said that the Tom Cruise character in Magnolia, that you guys had done a sketch like that.
I don't think I could accuse anyone of stealing it.
Mm. Okay.
We did a sketch about like a pickup artist class, essentially.
Yeah.
Which, you know, but before Mystery, was that his name?
God.
Yeah, it was
pre-Mystery. We were ahead of the curve. I don't think P.T. Anderson happened to swing by Catch Rising Star.
He said he was very insistent that there were like lines specifically from you guys' sketch.
It's possible. I mean, no,
that's kind of what
I'm
going to
say. It's not possible.
I was like, I don't know.
I'm not a, you know, I am an anti-believer in conspiracy theories.
Mm.
Not because I think that people aren't evil. I certainly think people are evil. But I just think that conspiracy theories, they give people too much credit. Like, you know, what's the principle that, like, never blame something that could be blamed on stupidity or incompetence?
It's not Occam's razor.
Yeah, it's not.
Like
it's somebody else's razor.
Occam's razor.
No, Occam's razor is whatever the simplest explanation is. But it's
which
somebody
kind
else's
of actually
razor.
Can you could apply Occam's razor or conspiracy
yes.
theories and come to the, like the same conclusion.
Yes, you probably could.
Yeah.
But you know, in terms of theft, you know, like joke stealing and stuff mm-hmm. like that. I mean, sometimes if it's a straight up like angle or like a line that's just so idiosyncratic. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of times it's just people overestimate how original their thoughts are.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
I'm the
yeah.
only one who could have had this amazing take on forks. No one else yeah. could possibly.
Who's going to build the wall?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
The wall to Mexico.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, that
do you remember
was,
that? Was
Jesse Joyce and I used to refer to something called the hack pot. Which oh. is when you could confer, like combine multiple hack premises at once, like or something that just like a joke so obvious that like 10 comics in the same week would come up with it, and like
right.
that wall one is a perfect example.
Oh, yeah.
And it was I had a joke. I mean, I'm not proud to admit this, but I had a joke about the Valtrex commercials early on. You uh-huh. know, about like them canoeing and stuff. And
didn't you steal that from P.T. Anderson?
Yeah. After he actually made it. He's making an entire movie around that joke. Uh-huh. But it was very early on, you know, that was a pretty
right.
easy target. And, you know, I guess a lot of people had joke. Even though everyone was like, everyone has a joke like that. I think I saw someone do that once. But then after, like, shows, people would be like, yeah, you stole that from me. And I was like,
no,
that's like a pretty common
not, yeah, it's
thing.
Not.
So I stopped doing it because crazy people started like.
Sometimes I overthink that or whatever. You know, it's I had a bit that I was kind of. not excited about, but I was kind of happy with about sex robots. Mm-hmm. But it's the kind of thing where it's very in the ether right now. Mm-hmm. Like Whitney Cummings has a long bit on her latest special mm-hmm. about sex robots. Mm-hmm. Bill Burr has one on his special about
yeah.
sex robots. And even though the angle that I have is different,
right?
It's just like, okay, is this just too corny? Like, is it just too done of a premise?
Well,
to
also
even
once people that big start doing it, I feel right. like it's almost ruined for everybody else.
A little bit, yeah.
Because it's then they're like, well, you know, you can have a totally different angle. But I once had a joke about tossing salad. I don't know if you ever heard me do that joke and. Mm. It's
so,
nothing
actually.
Like it's on my
Rocks,
first album.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
nothing like it's a completely different angle, but
you're literally talking about salad.
Yeah,
it's not even sexual at all.
I literally bring a salad on stage and just start tossing it.
You used to be a
well, that was a Gallagher ripoff.
Yeah.
Gallagher's fruit. I have salad. It's
I think you actually work very hard though to be very original on stage.
I try.
I think you're more aware than a lot of people are. You
yeah,
know?
I mean, I don't want to wonder. And mm. my thinking is if people in the audience are wondering whether they've heard it before, you've already lost.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Even if your take is completely original, once people are not in it with you, once they're kind of thinking with the sort of outside brains of like, I think like I heard this before. Mm-hmm. It's just why keep it? Just get rid of it. You
yeah.
know.
Right. Yeah, that's a good motto to have because a lot of people don't do that, and you can kind of tell sometimes when you think of something, you're like, this is a little too. I came up with a joke recently, and I was like, someone has to have done that, and then they were like, yeah, someone did that, but
yeah.
it was like someone I'd never seen, never. But it was like, you know, obviously you can just come up with the same joke.
Of course, yeah. There's parallel thinking, of course. I mean,
yeah.
I everyone has their own definition of hack.
Right.
My definition is like if I heard somebody else tell this joke, would I laugh at it? You know what I mean? And also, like, shit. Now I forgot what I was gonna say. I so amazed myself with my insight. Also, it's like leaning on, and I guess it's kind of related. Leaning onto what you know will work, as opposed to what you actually think is funny. Because sometimes
right.
you'll come up with something like, oh, that'll work.
Yeah.
Because you know the math of it works. Do you know what I mean? Like, oh, if I set it up like this, I'll do a misdirect and I'll say the opposite of what they think. And
right.
and that will be an effective joke and people will elicit the desired reaction of laughter. you know
right.
what I mean? Like,
And I think it's good to have those just kind of in your back pocket for like a really shitty gig where you're like, I know this will like get me out of this.
One, I think that, you know, ideally the joke, all of your jokes should work. But
yeah.
they should also make you laugh. You know
yeah,
what I mean?
Right.
That it's like they should all work, but sometimes you'll get stuck on a joke that just works even though you don't really think it's that funny, you know? And I think that's the kind of thing to, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, not necessarily, you're not always going to find your shit funny, but like, I think you should always be able to remind yourself, like, when I first thought of this, mm-hmm. did I find this funny? You know, because obviously once you've done a joke 50 times, you know, it's not that funny to you anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
I think as someone who's like pretty like way newer than all you guys into comedy, having those back pocket like kind of hack premises is like survival mode for me.
Oh, sure.
And so I don't know if I'm like learning to do stand up the wrong way, but I definitely catch myself going, feeling bad about a good set or quote unquote good set if I use too many of those.
Yeah.
Or, you know, or if it, like a premise that I could guess the punchline if I heard it.
Right.
That's definitely hack. Like that would be my definition.
Yeah.
Hack,
yeah. You know?
And I have like one. Definitely, that it's in my current rotation.
I came up with a joke a couple weeks ago, and I was like, I don't know about. Like, I think it's like okay.
Yeah.
I'm sorry I haven't brought it up. Now I have to tell it.
Yeah, you do.
You gotta put yourself into a corner.
Yeah, that was my plan the whole time, just to get you guys to listen to my jokes. That's what this whole podcast is.
Well, there's certain premises that, you know, like the one I always bring up is like dating sites. You know, you see so many comics talking about that. That's why I don't like to do those jokes.
I do jokes about that.
Yeah.
But I guess it's like, I mean.
I love your Bumble joke, though.
I think it's only like, if you're going to do a certain topic, it has to be something that you're like, okay, well, this is a very good take on it.
Right. Yeah, you have to go deeper into it. Yeah,
right.
For sure.
I don't know
what
I do, but I mean, I have one joke, a Bumble joke that people are like, "Oh, that's a people are very like complimentary."
Yeah, it works.
It's really good.
The joke
a lot of
that
buzz,
I
a lot of buzz.
There's a lot of buzz around that.
That's the punchline.
Basically,
yeah,
Bumble.
But so I want to get so basically, when did you start? Did you start doing stand up here in New York City?
I started in 1997 or 98. I can't remember.
And did you studied acting, right? Like in college?
When I originally went to college, I went to a tiny little boutique school called New York University. And I went as an actor.
I've heard of that.
Yeah, a little people. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I went as an actor, and then like in the middle of my sophomore year, I quit that. I'm not quit school, but I left acting conservatory.
Which studio were you in? Aren't there different studios?
Yes, I was in what is now called, I think it's just called Atlantic Theater Company, but I was in the Practical Aesthetics Workshop. Which was like David Mamet and William H. Macy's thing.
Wow.
Really?
Yeah, it's like their technique that they had created together.
So were
like
they?
William H. Macy was a teacher of mine for a semester.
Really?
Wow.
Yeah. Like pre-Fargo. Like he had been in some movies, but it was pre-Fargo, so he wasn't like a name yet.
Right, and he started out like kind of with Mamet, right?
Yes,
they're Chicago
guys.
Right, right. Because I remember he's in that movie House of Games.
Yes.
That's one of his earliest things that Mamet wrote.
He was a Mamet guy, and then he eventually started doing other stuff.
And why did you quit? Because it was because you loved it?
I didn't like actors. Well, and not so much. I didn't like what the world of acting was. You know, the way NYU worked is if you were in the conservatory acting program, it's Monday, Wednesday, Friday, you went to your acting school, and then Tuesday, Thursday, you had your quote-unquote academics. And I found myself enjoying my Tuesdays and Thursdays more than my Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays.
Right.
And a lot of people I knew, and this is still true of like actors that I know. It's like they could go a year without acting.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. And when they do act, they have to jump at any crappy play that they can get into. And then I can't tell you how many times somebody's been like, "Hey, can you come see my play? It kind of sucks, but would you please just come see it?"
Yeah.
You know, it's like it's awful.
Like, and I'll be there.
I don't blame them, but it's just like so I quit and I was a playwriting major. Sort of. I was a playwriting major. But then by the time I graduated, I was interning at the Village Voice, like doing like nonfiction writing and crap like that. And then after college, I did some sort of freelance journalism stuff and worked at a literary agency. And then I kind of missed performing. And so I kind of got into stand-up just because it was a combination where it was like, you're performing, but it's your stuff.
And how did that happen? Was someone like, "You should do that," or were you like, "I'm going to do that"? Because I'm always interested how people finally make the leap to do stand up. Because it does seem like, I mean, when I talk to people, but also for me, it took me years to finally. Because people are like, "You should," and I didn't. I was like, "I don't like that," you know, because I was young and I was like, "Yeah, that seems hard."
Well, I hated stand up in college and high school and stuff because I was very black turtlenecky. And I thought, you know, I'm an artiste.
Yeah.
And when I look back, though, it was so clear that I wanted to do stand-up. Like, when I was a kid, I was obsessed with Steve Martin and SNL and all that kind of stuff. And
you were always standing up.
I was constantly standing up. I just every
so
apartment
obvious.
I would paint a brick wall onto the
getting out of chairs a lot. Yeah. No, go ahead.
No, sorry. It's
But people with acting backgrounds usually can make that jump to stand up easier. I've seen that. Like, I'm sure when you probably started, you were probably better than a lot of people of your peers.
Maybe. I mean, I don't know. I felt more natural being on stage, I guess.
Yeah.
But yeah, I when I was working in publishing, my thoughts were, you know, like, I'll work in publishing during the day, and at night I'll write a novel, and I'll be a writer, and all that. And then I found that I wasn't writing anything. Mm. And so I had basically no actual creative, you know, outlet anymore. And so Time Out New York had just come out. It just started being published in New York. And so I started just flipping through, just going to stuff. Like, I went to a few poetry slams. I was like, maybe that'll be my thing. And then I quickly realized, yeah, definitely not.
Yeah.
And then I went to, I saw the original UCB.
It was on, like, yeah. Was that when they were like on 20?
Yeah, a solo,
or something?
But not even in their own theater. They were at a place called Solo Arts Group, like on 26th or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just absolutely loved it. And I Bring the Pain, the Chris Rock special, came out around time,
yeah.
And I really fell in love with that. And I didn't know, I had such a negative impression of stand-up. To me, you know, I kind of became, my young adult years were in the sort of stand-up boom of the late 80s and early 90s, and it was all kind of like purple blazer with the sleeves pushed up, and you know, kind of all style, no substance. And I didn't know anything about that you could do kind of quote unquote alt type stand-up.
Right.
You know, and I was a huge fan of the Ben Stiller show.
And then
when Jeanine Garofalo started doing stand-up, and it was like, I don't think that people fully appreciate what Jeanine meant to a certain generation of comics. Even people who might not have loved her stand-up, whatever, but she was the first person I ever saw do stand-up who seemed like somebody I would actually hang out with.
And also, yeah, and that whole alt style, kind of, she was like the first, she was like a superstar who had the alt style. She had her, like, I love that she had her notebook, because that became like my thing. I was like, yeah, that's cool.
And to me, and I've asked this, I've said this to her, and she kind of looked at me like I was, you know, had 10 eyes, but the thing that I always took from that, especially against the backdrop of what stand-up felt like at that period, is that the whole notes on stage thing, to me, it was like a subconscious way of expressing what I'm saying is more important than the manner in which I'm saying it. Mm. That it's not all about, like, here's my polished 4 minutes. It made it genuine. It made it feel like there's a real human being talking to you. You know?
Right. That's why I'm from here, and I did stand up for like 6 months before I went to LA. And I remember I moved there in like 2000, and I went to Largo. And you know, it's like, I just started doing stand up. I didn't know what, you know, you don't know what you're doing. And I saw, you know, at Largo they had a music stand on stage. You probably did that show, right?
No, I never did. They had
a place for you, the comics, to put their notes. Not only it was basically like you had to bring notes.
Yeah, there definitely were some alt shows, and there still are. Sometimes you do the sort of quote unquote alt shows or bar shows where if you're too polished, the audience kind of like revolts against
it.
Totally.
Have you ever tried to pretend that you didn't have a bit memorized to make it look more alty?
Loser,
like,
dude.
Oh, what was I gonna say? This bit I've done 8,000 times.
Literally.
What was I gonna say?
Watch me at Black Hat on
Valtrex.
Friday. It's me.
No, so I loved that because I was very not polished. You know what I mean? It's kind of how my brain up, and I'm very anti-phoniness, so I always did hate that, like, hey, you guys,
exactly.
I hated that, like, what are you guys doing, look at where you're from, oh, look at how you ever do this, and you're just so I love, and I also love that they weren't like trying to talk, it was like about them, and it was also like, I love that it was like new stuff was encouraged a lot, that's why they had the notes, because it was like, I just wrote this, you know.
Yeah,
like,
and you know, and it hasn't, you know, I think most people, if they were to watch me now, would not see that really in what I do, because I probably am more on the polished end of things. But I never would have gotten into stand-up, you know, and it's so funny because now I'm older and I can kind of acknowledge what a genius Brian Regan is.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was younger...
Yeah, yeah.
He was like everything I didn't like about stand-up, you know, back when he used to host like Short Attention Span Theater and Comedy Central, and he had the mullet and stuff. And honestly, I didn't even know any of his bits. I just thought, I was like, oh, that's what corny stand-up comedy looks like.
He just looked the part so much. That's what it was.
He looked like 1988.
He did. He totally did.
I mean, yeah, looking at those pictures now is a real trip. Like the pictures from the comedy boom, like the first comedy boom. It's interesting because I kind of think about like now, it feels like we're in some sort of other comedy boom or something, or at least like with the internet, there has been like podcasting and like all these new forms of media, and stand-up seems to be at like the forefront of that. So I get a little nervous that I started stand-up at the exact wrong time.
There is no right or wrong time. I think that's what I think there's always going to be a grass is greener kind of attitude.
It's always the wrong time.
It's always the wrong time.
Right, that's true.
It's like there's never like
never been said.
There's
twice.
Never a right time to start doing porn. I feel like I started doing porn at the wrong time. Because I do remember. No, I'm sorry.
Go ahead. But I also think that, I mean, you and especially you were the two types of comedians that you came from. Maybe you were in the alt world, but you could also do clubs. And there was, I didn't think there was always a lot of comics that could do that. You guys were definitely two people that would do well in both.
What you were talking about, like the I feel like there's a fine line between being too polished and being too unprepared. That was a big problem in the alt scene. Some people I felt took it too far the other way of like. Would just get up there and be like, well, you know, I was thinking, like, you ever, like, go outside? Yeah. Well, you know, like, what? You know, you're like, that's not a bit yet.
And also it's like people would affect the unpreparedness as sort of a pose, you know, to cover up for their own insecurities, you know. And also the more unprepared you are, the more interesting your thoughts have to be. You know, there are certain people, they're just fascinating, and I'll listen to them kind of work it out on stage because the way their brains work is interesting to me.
Mm. Yeah.
But if you're not just an off-the-cuff, brilliant human being, write some fucking jokes.
Yeah. And I think I feel like I always kind of, that, because at the time, I could still do clubs because I had jokes, but I think the reason I liked alt is it was very accepted. They loved it, the fact that you would go up and be like, oh, I just wrote this, because I would always hear that. I think that's why they started to like me, you know, and that's why they liked people. They'd be like, I've never heard any of that. You never, and I'm like, I just kind of like came up with it. But I would never, you know, I never wanted to do badly. I don't like being in front of people when no one's liking it. So I would go up with like ideas, you know what I mean?
Right.
I'm
22, however, 22 years into this, and I still don't know if I'm an alt-leaning club comic or a clubby alt comic. Like I don't know.
When I was in the middle of that scene, I would people would always hear grumblings of like I did this club once and they were like, yeah, he just went in there and did all his alt stuff. Like, the clubs would call me an alt comic, and then sometimes alt rooms would say I was, like, a club comic.
Yeah, you know.
So I kind of thought it was a compliment.
I mean, it is in a sense. That, like Eric was saying, it's like I was always very proud that I could swim in both of those pools, but it made me – I was never the coolest in either. You know, I never felt like the belle of the ball in either. I still don't, you know.
Yeah. So when you – all right, so when I met you, it was around when you – when you did that Chappelle show,
I guess so. Yeah.
Was that 2003?
I think 2003 is when I think it actually came out. I think we shot it like the late fall of 2002. I think
because you had done like Premium Blend, right? And then you had that show at the Gershwin.
Portable comedy, baby. It was a youth hostel in Garment District.
But I remember it was like a popular show, and it was like when I first was getting into comedy, like because I moved back to New York in like 2002.
Yeah.
And I had done comedy for a couple years in LA, but no one knew me here, so it was like starting over, which is kind of good because I kind of had some chops, and it was kind of good because I could tell I was a little better because people would be like, so where are you from?
Yeah. Right,
like after I would do a set,
right,
like, and that was the first the two questions I could tell I did well were. Where are you from? How long have you been here? And another one was, how old are you?
Do I need to be concerned about you? Or are you somebody who's been doing this forever?
So I always took that as a compliment. If someone would be like, how old are you? And I'd be like, 20.
Yeah, I think there's definitely pros and cons to, I mean, I started here. And, you know, whatever, you can't redo history. Mm. But there's definitely a pro to having kind of gotten your shittiness out of your system and then showing up sort of fully formed. Yeah. But a lot of comics, you can't move here too late. I know a lot of comics mm-hmm. that I totally respect from other places, and they move here too late because they're not able to just take the ball kicking of that,
yeah, that's a good
like
point.
18 months of people treating you like an open micer, even though you're like a road headliner.
Right, yeah. That is the hard.
There's so many comics I can think of, and I don't know why they left, but that are like real, legit, great comics, and they just can't. They can't struggle for one set a week. Because I'm a real comic and I can't handle it.
I remember that. I would meet these comics who kind of were road comics, and I would be like, you know, I was doing a lot of the alt rooms. There would be kind of like, I didn't do the alt, they weren't like cool when I started, you know, you probably remember this. Like, a scene kind of like formed around it. It kind of became the thing.
We were lucky in the sense, you know, this has been on my mind today because of Bloomberg. One of my main, like, personal gripes with Bloomberg is that he turned Manhattan into a pied-à-terre for foreign millionaires. And, you know, that everything is so balkanized now. You know, when we were doing comedy in that period, a lot of the cool shows were within a 10-minute walk of each other. Mm. You know,
right,
you could go from Parkside to Rafifi to, you know, Surf Reality. Or, you know, they were all generally clustered in the East Village and Lower East Side, and there'd be random ones here and there in other neighborhoods. But now, you know, there's the Brooklyn rooms, and, you know, obviously my wife owns QED in Queens, and so I'm
partial to it. And by the way, because what we were actually talking about before, that's a room, the QED, which it's a great room. The crowd there is kind of a mix of alti, I think.
I think that's why I like it. It's a reflection of my wife and I, for sure. Yeah. I mean, it's my wife's place, but obviously, my being a comedian.
Do you get any spots there?
It's hard. I don't
He's got to bring 10 people.
That much, really. Just because, first of all, everybody there knows me, and a lot of times I have to work there. Like, my wife had breast cancer a couple years ago, and she had to be gone. She's fine now. Okay. But, I was working, you know, helping while she wasn't able to be there, and still I'm there a lot, and so it's hard sometimes to then be like, hey, I know I was the guy that was carrying that case of beer down the stairs, but now watch me do comedy.
It's like, hey, you guys ever been carrying beer down the stairs before?
Now, I mean, I do. Like, I am next week. Actually, I'm running a new 45 there next week, but I try to not perform there too much because it's just. Is a lot of regulars, and I don't want to burn out on it.
So you had the show at the Gersh. I remember like getting on it, and it was like, I remember you were actually very nice because you had put out an advertisement about whatever, an email blast about it, and you had my name on the line. It was kind of like, you know, it was one of those things. It was like a good show to get on.
Well, I think it had a moment. You know, a lot of those shows. You know, and I'm sure you know you've booked shows. It just, for about 6 months, it was a hot show.
Yes.
And then it just kind of petered off. It was kind of lame-ish, but okay. And then it got amazing, where it's sold out every week. And then it was just time. Shows have a shelf life.
It was and I think Borelli was doing his show there at the same time.
I took over. No, I took over his show.
Oh, that's what it was.
It was Patrick Borelli and then Julia Sharp. And I don't remember who had it first. But I took it over. I always hated the name Portable Comedy. But.
And I remember you wrote something on the like invite that was like, because I was like pretty new to New York, and you wrote something like, oh, this guy's like new to New York, and he's like tearing it up lately. And I always was like, wow, that was really nice of you to do that.
Were you tearing it up?
Yeah, were you? Well, I was like, you know, I was new.
His set list, yes. He was tearing it up.
I used to do this Pelosi impression. It was very prescient. I was like, you guys are going to love this in about 20 years. I mean, you know, it was like I was getting, you know, I was at that phase. Like, I was probably about 3 years in, and I was, you know, I thought I was good.
At the time felt like, this is like, I'm a professional. 3 years.
I know what I'm doing.
Is that how I'm supposed to feel?
Yeah.
Are you three years in now?
Yep.
Buckle up.
Approaching it.
I probably feel less like I know what I'm doing now.
Oh,
than
absolutely.
I did then.
Yeah, 100%. I if there's one thing that I miss, it's a sense of hubris, you know, a sense of everything's gonna work out, and I got it all. Everything's, you know, my
being 28 is something else.
Absolutely,
it is amazing. And I think
28 is always the number that I think of when I think of like if you're gonna be one age for the rest of your life. 28.
That's a good age.
I remember when I was 28 being like, wow, this is a great because it was like you're not old. You're not really young. You kind of have some, you know, experience under your belt. You're not about to be 30. You're about to be 29, which is still like, oh, you're still 29 was a rough one.
And maybe for me, it's because it's the year before I met my wife.
Oh, really? This is making me feel better. I just turned 28 in January. Oh, 3 years in, I feel like we're describing me.
These are your salad days. Enjoy them.
I'm gonna start tossing.
The worst part is you're gonna look back on this moment right now as a good time.
Oh yeah. I'm having a great time.
No,
I have a question.
Raise the bar.
Yeah, exactly.
You probably had a lot people ask you about the Chappelle Show sketch. I mean, was that a big part? Like, were people always recognizing you for that for a while? Or
the way it went down?
It was huge.
It was huge. Oh my God. Yeah. It was really only like 2005, 2006 where it started. It was when it came out on DVD.
Yeah,
that's when it went nuts. You know, because it was the Mad Real World sketch that I was in, and when we shot it, the show hadn't been on the air yet. It was still in development.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Oh, okay.
And so, I mean, I remember we had like a table read, you know, where all the actors sit around the table, and they were reading like three sketches. It was my sketch. It was the Clayton Bigsby white supremacist sketch, and I don't remember what the third one was, but it was one of the tentpole big sketches from that first season.
Right, right.
And I remember thinking like, this is hilarious, and it will never get on the air. Like, there's no chance. Right. There's no chance. And so it all seemed kind of funny to me.
Your skit? You didn't think it would get on?
No, the Clayton Bigsby one I didn't think would get on. But any of it. I just kind of thought like, oh, this show's going to get canceled before it hits the air. There's no chance.
You called that one.
But yeah, and so it definitely, like when it came out, it was a big deal and it was great. But it was a couple years when the DVD came out, that's when it was, I mean, there was a time, right around the time when I got married, like 2005, 2006, 2007, like that, those couple years, where it was 10 times a day. You know, people interrupting your meal, just like I'd be arguing with my wife, so we walk up, Kay's got some big ass titties, and like right away, you know.
Honestly, I gotta say, it's up there as one of the funniest comedy sketches of
all
time.
Oh, I feel I feel like somebody who caught a home run ball, you know. Like,
I mean, you made it too, though.
I was, you know, I didn't ruin it, but I take very little
you
personal responsibility.
It's also a really long skit, right?
Well, what's funny is that if it had been in season two, I think it would have been the whole episode, because I saw the original cut. They cut a lot out. The original cut was like 23 minutes long.
Oh, wow.
And then they cut it down, ended up being like 15 or something, split into two parts of the episode. But the way they did the Rick James thing, where it was the entire episode, I think if the show had been a success already, they probably, because it was actually worked out well for me, because a lot of the other roommates in the house had really funny bits, but they were cut out for time, but they couldn't really cut my stuff out because it was kind of the skeleton of the plot.
Like the through line.
Right, right.
But yeah, there was this one scene that they cut out, and I'm going to say it. There was one of the roommates is a woman named Chandra, and there was a scene where a guy, the door knocks, and I go, and I open the door, and it's this guy holding an infant, and he says, yo, tell Chandra to take a trifling-ass baby back. And he hands me this baby, so I'm just holding this infant. And I'm like, Chandra, I think this is your baby. And she's like, I got to tie my shoes. And she just bolts. Like, I don't think that would fly so well in 2020. But,
nothing flies now.
Was it a real infant?
It was an actual baby, yeah.
Yeah, well, that's a good follow-up. Are you having any issues with political correctness with the crowds or the woke crowds and anything like that? I mean, I don't feel like you're acting.
I find the opposite, honestly. Mm. It's like, I don't mind... I mean, of course, everyone's looking to be righteous. And it's not a left thing or a right thing. Everyone wants to go viral. And so being offended by something is the easiest way to try to get your likes and faves. I saw this and I was upset about it. But I find it just as much people on the right as the left, you know. And I don't mind. Yeah, of course there are times when people are just full of shit. There's a lot of people who are just plain full of shit.
Do you ever get that during your show, though? But probably
some every once in a while, not me, but it's like I adjust. I mean, I don't think they're wrong. I don't, you know, individual people are full of shit. But I feel like if there's sort of a cultural trend line that is going in a certain direction, I'm not afraid of admitting that maybe, you know, well, I think of like things like racism and sexism and whatnot. it's in the water we drink. It's in the air that we breathe. Where it's not anybody's fault. It's like, you know, people used to say retard all the time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It, you know, I don't have to. That doesn't make me a terrible person that I used to say that. We all said it. But that doesn't mean that I have to like plant my flag and be like, I'm going to keep saying it.
Right, anyone
who tells me not to is somehow wrong, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, you think of comedy in the 1920s. It changes. It constantly evolves.
Exactly. You know, and a lot of people, you know, when they complain about the woke people or whatever, I agree. A lot of it is very annoying. But I bet if you went back in history, back to like when the suffragettes were trying to get the women's vote or during the civil rights, I bet people would have felt the exact same way about people fighting for like voting rights and things. Like, oh my God, they won't shut up. They're so annoying.
It's just totally, it's literally just human nature. It's weird experience because like getting older, you know, seeing this happen is kind of a thing of like, oh, I've been alive so long, I'm seeing things change.
Yeah.
And now it's weird to me how things that were happening are not accepted anymore. Not that don't even seem long ago. Like
they're not. Well, I think that the internet has sped up the cycle.
Oh, totally.
Like
things
used to evolve over the course of a generation. Now things evolve over the course of like 3 years. You know, things that were weird, things were normal 3 years ago. People are like, oh, that's a little.
And then I'll watch like just any old sitcom and like.
Oh yeah.
Thing everything that happens in like the Fresh Prince is like, oh, you can't do that. The whole thing, remember when sitcoms, a big thing was just, and not even just sitcoms, but shows of like, there would be a girl and they would just kind of jokingly like just grab the girl, like MASH.
Yeah,
Hawkeye
yeah.
was always just grabbing a girl and kissing her because he was just like a, kind of a ladies man.
right.
And the girl would always just kind of get into it.
Woo!
And because he was such a great kisser, I guess.
Yeah.
And it's amazing watching it. You're like, holy shit.
You always bring up, not even MASH, way more recent than that, you always bring up the Oscar kiss with Adrian Brody.
I brought that up last time. I was saying that I looked that up specifically like about a week before this year's Oscars. I was like,
I mean,
holy shit, I bet you that hasn't aged well.
I watched it myself. It is bad. He just grabs her. She's not expecting it.
And she kind of like is, and she's laughing. And I think that's
because she's nervous and like, what the hell's going on?
Yeah, yeah. Well, she's not going to be like, get away from me, you Oscar winner.
I think so often men will do that. They'll be like, hey, she didn't complain or she laughed or she was laughing. It's like, yeah, because there's a societal awkwardness to not wanting to upset the herd, not make a scene. You know, it's when.
She's a black woman at the Oscars.
Yeah, like you're now putting her in a position where she either has to, and again, there's like a lot of sexual abuse people. People who have suffered sexual abuse.
That's the name of this podcast.
Even, it's not even just that it happened. It's them hating themselves for how they either reacted or didn't react to it after the fact. It's like you know, not that what Adrian Brody does is the same thing as like molesting a child or whatever, but it's like now you're putting Halle Berry in a situation where it's like my choices are to just laugh it off and accept it, even though it was totally inappropriate and not cool, or to be that woman who's making a big fucking deal about it. Like you've now dropped this into my lap where I'm fucked either way.
Live television.
Yeah.
Well, and the other thing is like I understand, you know, in the moment, of course, you know, I don't even know if you're making a conscious choice to like laugh it off. You're just kind of nervous and but even if she had brought it up a week later, people would have been like, what are you doing? What are you talking about?
Well, that's
like, wasn't even like a weird.
Well, that's what's so weird is the reaction. And you're right about this. You brought this up in the last episode or whatever. The reaction in the crowd is like an immediate like, oh,
they're
he's
like,
the man.
Yeah, go for it. And I think what makes it creepier is he goes, I bet you they didn't tell you that was in the gift bag. And he says it like that.
Oh, that's horrible.
And then they show her and she's kind of wiping her mouth, like almost that it was like that she's covered. And so it's even like,
to Christian's point, it's probably better that our reaction in 2020 wouldn't be that.
Yeah.
You know, the general trend, sure, the cancel people are probably not, like, I think everyone should be allowed to try and say or be funny. But
we
like,
should be able to try to kiss women without asking for it. No,
I mean, it's a different thing when it's actions.
No,
like
you're
that,
right. It's annoying, but the general trend line drags you in the right direction.
I agree with that. Yeah.
But and you're a little political. I mean, I know. Remember, you used to watch you were on MSNBC, and
I mean, I'd like to be more. It doesn't fly.
Yeah, you don't do Trump jokes on.
Well, I do
on stage.
I do, but I can't do them everywhere. It's frustrating.
Mm. Were you always like that early on?
No, it's definitely something as I got older.
When did it shift?
Probably when I started doing Keith Olbermann. That's kind of when I started. I mean, I was on Best Week Ever.
Right.
Right.
And
it was a huge show.
Yeah.
That was, and then I got Keith Olbermann, at the end of his show, he would bring people on every once in a while to do sort of the lighter side, like pop culture.
Yeah.
And so I went on Keith Olbermann a few times doing that. But then he started letting me kind of actually talk about lighter side of politics, but still politics. And then I think that's probably when I got super engaged about that kind of
thing. Were you on Best Week Ever from the beginning of it?
Yes, I was on the very first episode. I was actually the way that went down is in 2001 I won a car on a game show.
What?
VH1's Name That Video, because I was like a music obsessive and a music video obsessive, and even though I was just like an open micer at the time, it was like before Premium Blend and all that. I kind of got a little bit of a reputation among the people at VH1 because of that. Oh, this guy knows like trivia.
Right.
And so I was brought in with some other people to do an internal pilot, which for people who don't know what that means. That means like when they'll make a pilot of a show that never is on the air. It's just for sort of the decision makers to watch. Of a show called I Love the 80s. And they had just a bunch of nobodies, you know, come in and basically do what became I Love the 80s. And when they picked up that show, they were like, perfect, now let's replace all these open mic comics with like third tier celebrities.
Right.
And so when they started Best Week Ever a year or two later, whenever it was, they remembered me from that, and they kind of went into Best Week Ever being like, we want to create, rather than trying to get like Sports Center anchors and random celebrities, like let's find a core group of like young comics and sets.
Yeah, because
I thought that was great for comics. I mean, they would show that show like
I
mean
50 times a day.
I will say it kills me though that it didn't exist when like Twitter and social media took off. Because man, what Guy Code and Girl Code did for like the next class of comedians, like we missed out on all of that. Like there was no way. I mean, I got a lot of road work out of it, and I got a lot of notoriety, and it was great for a number of reasons, but I was not able to sort of hold on to that audience the way that a lot of the next class of VH1 and MTV2 people were able to.
You see those guys have like millions of followers.
Well, yeah, but the clippable content of like that style of show is perfect for social media and sharing, and you're not burning material. You're just talking about topical stuff.
Yeah.
It's perfect.
I remember, so I was doing a bunch of those talking head shows before that, like just random VH1 talking head shows. And then I did one on like True TV. No, I did one on True TV later after. So I got on Best Week Ever, but it was like at the way end of it. So like a lot of people on it were already very established. So I was the last guy in, and like I think the first three episodes, I just wasn't in it. So like I stopped.
Well, that was the thing is that you would that would happen to you.
But not
on,
to
like,
you. You would because you were there from. You were one of the big guys I had to compete with.
Well, there were.
It seemed like you came up with your own stuff, maybe a little bit.
Well, they would always give you like a packet of like they would tell you ahead of time like here's the topics we're going to talk about and here's some sort of joke angles like and then you would write your jokes, and sometimes they would flat out give you jokes. And
that was the only time
good,
I got on. They'd be like, they'd be like, because I
read
need all
someone
the,
to say X.
Yeah, like I like it was great. I mean, I don't mind writing, but it was a lot of writing.
Yeah, it was. It
and
was
like,
a lot of
and I would do all these jokes, and then they'd be like, "Why don't you just say this?"
And
they didn't do it meanly, but did you have this experience like? It a lot of it depended on who was interviewing you because there were a few people that would like. You know, they're not allowed to laugh, but they would show you that they were trying not to laugh, and then there'd be just dead stone face.
Absolutely. Oh, 100%. There were people who, like, if you walked in and they were the producer that you had to work with that day, you're like, oh, I'm fucked this week because this person's going to give me nothing, and they're not going to like. Whereas other producers would be like, oh, hey, what if you spun it this way? Like, you kind of, like, banter with them. And
they would make you feel more comfortable. There was one guy, I remember, he'd go, you know, it's hard because you're just in a room with, like, this, you know, the crew guys are just bored. They don't want to be. They've been there all week. And this guy, every time I'd do a joke, he'd go, is that it? Is that the end of it?
I would always
and I'd be
try
like,
to...
Yep, that's it.
I would always try to include a joke or two that I knew wouldn't get on the air, but that would just get, like, the camera dude's attention.
Oh, that's fun.
Just,
smart. Oh, that's good.
And also, my theory was, is that if I do a couple of jokes that are just way over the line... then they won't cut the jokes that I really like.
Oh, makes them seem less.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Yep. Unfortunately, one of them actually made it onto the show, and I was kind of embarrassed by it. There was a thing that happened where...
Were you appraising Adrian Brody?
No.
The Halle Berry thing?
That was when it was good before it was social media, because he would have...
Yeah, probably. I would have been embarrassed by it. But there was a thing where Michael Clark Duncan had seen Ben Affleck's penis when they were filming Daredevil, and it sort of implied that Ben Affleck had a small penis. and I said something like, you know, that's just not cool. Like, you would never see Annette Bening talk about Calista Flockhart's big floppy vagina or something like that.
You know, it's funny. I think I remember that. Yeah. I think I remember seeing that.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Well, it's clearly made a mark. But what I found out later, because I started to get frustrated, like anybody, you know, there's certain people, and I'm sure I was one of them for a while, where it's like, this guy again? Like, why are they using 10 of his jokes? Those jokes aren't that great. I made the same joke. Why didn't they use my version instead of his when they already have all these jokes? And the reason why, though, is pure fucking laziness.
Yeah.
Is that a lot of times, a lot of these producers, like, we're on deadline. We could load Tom's tape, but we already have Finnegan's loaded, so let's just use that.
Yeah, and I didn't
That's
really...
That's how you got screwed out.
I think what happened was, and this happens a lot, there were a lot of producers who would do segments, and I think there were like two or three that there was one that really liked me. I think that's why I stayed on it. But then the other ones, I think, like, didn't like me. It kind of depended on how they felt about you. You know what
I
mean?
Sure. Yeah, it's very, very true.
So it was one of those things. It started out like I was like, wow. First of all, I remember auditioning and being so nervous and being like, and thinking I was just awful and like being like, there's no way I'm gonna get this. And then I got on it. Like, I was doing the audition. I remember at one point this guy going, Just relax.
Yeah, that doesn't install.
Yeah, I was like, oh, that's not
good. That's
going
to have the opposite effect of what you're going for.
So I was kind of, I think one of the producers liked me a lot. And but I was very happy. And then I finally started to get on it, and then they changed the format. I don't know what your experience was with that, with Paul F. Tompkins became the host.
That
how
whole
is the show
thing.
Not on it?
Because Twitter exists, all the jokes are already made. I really think that's what it is.
You're right.
People are doing it. They're filming themselves front-facing cameras. Like, they're already, it's already done. I mean,
yeah, immediately. Right. You can't wait until, like, it's because it used to be really like, yeah, is. Like, oh, here's a joke from somebody that happened Monday. That's, yeah, people not, forgot about that.
Things are
by
done by
Friday.
Wednesday now. Yeah.
That's probably, and at the same time, it kind of went off the air is when social media was exploding.
Yeah. No, I mean, I was really pissed about the whole change in format thing because what happened is. Best Week Ever was a thing. And then E! Came out. I auditioned for the show that became The Soup.
Right.
It was called the What Are Awards, I think was the original title of it. It was basically just Best Week Ever, but with one host. And it became a success in a way that Best Week Ever couldn't, because The Soup had one host and they could send, hey, it's Joel McHale from The Soup, and we can put him on late night shows, we can put him out. Whereas like Best Week Ever, it's like there's 50 different people. And so VH1 kind of saw that and were like, that sucks. They took our thing and made it better. And so we need to do that. We need to make it a one person show. And I remember when the writers were changing the format, they tried to pitch it in a way that was like, really got under my skin, especially somebody who I considered a friend.
Say their name.
No, because it's not her fault. She had a job like anybody else. But she was like, hey, great news. We're starting. We're going to reboot the show, and it's going to be different. And it's like, instead of being like a partner at the law firm, you're going to work in the mailroom. How does that sound? and like, because they still wanted us to be involved, but just like showing up for 30 seconds a week, maybe. You know, it's like, well, no, it can't. And at the time, I pretty much run my course on it. Because I hated all that stuff. Yeah. Like, I hate pop culture and Lindsay Lohan. And
oh, really?
I hated it. I always hated it.
You can get bored of talking about that over and over again.
Yeah, I just felt like I was ready to not do that
anymore.
How many
years did you do it?
I mean, from the beginning until then, so that whole...
They changed it around 2009, 2010?
Yeah, so I guess about 5 or 6 years is... Because
I remember I came in, and it might have been the same woman who was saying it, pitching it to me. I mean, I'd been on it like 6 months, but I wasn't on it every week, and I was barely on it, and... I had heard that they were changing formats, and she was like, and she did this. Oh, great news! It's going to be this thing, but
I bet it is.
It's going to be like different. We're like, let's cut to Tom McCaffrey in the field, and I remember being like, "There's no way I'm on the show." and
Well, and they kind of fucked themselves because it's like, I love, like, Paul is like one of my five favorite comics ever, period.
Yeah, yeah, I loved him. Like, yeah. And he's super nice. Like, meeting him on that show was like a big deal to me.
He's just absolutely brilliant. But that wasn't going to work.
No.
Because he's like, there's a lot of people that watch that show that really were just watching it because they wanted to see the dumb stuff we were making fun of.
Yeah.
They really didn't want. The original humor was like, yeah, that's fine and all, but we really just kind of want to know about what happened on The Simple Life, you know?
Right.
And so they didn't really want like a really wry artistic take on it. There are certain people, like Paul Scheer was really good on that show.
Yeah, a lot of big
because,
people came out of that. Mm-hmm. The
yeah, but
one.
He was specifically well suited for that show because he really did love all that stuff.
Yeah.
Like he, you know, because like Paul hates it. So do I. Like, you know, and I think that you needed to have somebody, if you were going to do that one host thing, you need to have somebody who actually kind of liked that stuff.
Oh, interesting.
Instead of sort of turning a jaundiced eye to all of it.
Did you jump in more into stand-up after that show was over?
I mean, I was doing stand-up the whole time. But
you did some specials, probably.
Shooting my first special when that was all going down. And so I kind of thought, I was like, well, fuck it, I'm moving on anyway. And, you know.
Yeah, I had that experience because I was on a True TV talking head show that went on after that. And I had done Best Week Ever. Because Best Week Ever, when I started doing it, people were at VH1 were like, oh, that's the best one. That's like the big one.
Mm-hmm.
And so like the True TV one, I was always like, oh, this one's so beneath me. It's so shitty.
Yeah, I had that same feeling. I wasn't even on those, but I always felt like, yeah.
And like
knockoffs.
The True TV kind of came the Comedy Network after now.
I know. And so they like stopped calling me. And I remember being like, I'm glad. I don't even like that shit. And then like 4 months went by and I was like, I wonder if I should contact them. Like, I'll put on a pig nose now. Because I remember, like, one of the first, I'd done Best Week Ever, and they were like, will you put on a pig nose for the skit? I was like, no. Then they were like, and it was like my first day. How ballsy. And I was like, no, I just don't want to do that. And I almost think they maybe liked that I was like, I had like integrity or something. But if I had integrity,
it's
I'm
called
not,
negging.
Yeah. All right. So I want to talk about, so.
Well, actually, can I bring up? Didn't you also had some? You had a special on Netflix, actually.
I had a special. I had a special on Netflix when people were still making fun of the idea of having specials on Netflix.
But oh, like, what year was that?
It would have been that 2014, I think it came out.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
But it was like people were doing it, but it was kind of like what?
Yeah.
You know, people were kind of mocking it in a way.
Did you get $20 million for it?
I did. Yeah. No, but then, you know, and honestly, what really sucks is that Netflix wasn't producing them themselves at that point. It was New Wave, it was an outside production company.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And so when Netflix rather started producing the specials themselves, they got rid of all the ones that weren't under the Netflix banner, except for the ones that are like hugely popular.
Okay.
And so I didn't even know it happened until somebody, because I used to be like, oh, this guy's got a special on Netflix. And then I got an email from somebody being like, I went on Netflix and your special isn't there. And it's just gone. I mean, you can rent it on like Amazon or whatever, but it's pay $4. But who's going to do that now?
Yeah. New Wave the same thing as Comedy Dynamics?
Go ahead.
Yeah.
No, go ahead.
Or yes.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm just curious. I mean, I know that there's like technically legal issues, but is there any way you can... Do you have any ownership of that material? Like
videos?
I
should probably look into it. I'm not
I'm a lawyer.
Good
so.
At being.
Yeah, he actually is. True. Yeah.
I'm not good with career stuff, but I don't know.
Well, I know that, you know, Bert Kreischer basically clipped his Showtime special where he told that machine story and put it on Facebook, even though they told him you can't do that. And then it like got millions of views and he kind of like blew up from that. Well, like he was already big, but still like I think that it's interesting.
I have no idea how to build a career. I seriously don't. I'm completely fucked because I spent my whole life being above caring about the business side of things and thinking that I was like, oh, I'm just not that kind of guy and I'm eating shit for it every day.
No, I had the same thing. I remember I was like, I'm not going to work. And I think it was a very, like, you know, Janine Garofalo-esque attitude. Like that was one thing when I would watch her or before I did comedy, I was always like, oh, that's how to be famous. Just like
to not want it.
Just look like you don't even want to be there.
Well, and also like to me, I mean, it's a very Gen X thing, you know.
Totally. Yeah, it is very Gen X.
Very much. And the idea, it's so funny to me. You know, whatever. Every generation is a reaction to the generation that precedes it. But the whole idea, like, if you had told me in when I was 23 years old, that people were going to start calling themselves brands in a way that wasn't
so
like humiliating.
Yeah. Right.
Because that's like, that's, ugh. I mean, and granted, we all were secretly doing that, but we acted like we weren't. You know, I mean, it's my voice. We'd call it
you
my voice instead of my brand.
Yeah.
But it's like, yeah, so the idea of actively trying to build a career was disgusting to me on some level. Mm-hmm. Like, it was like what a sellout would do.
Yeah,
and it's completely foolish on my part.
No, and I read an article actually recently about how Gen X, that encapsulated the attitude of Gen Xers. Because it was a very, like, the attitude of the child and the family who hadn't gotten a lot of attention. So you kind of developed a lot of like an aloofness. It's like, I don't give a shit. Like,
I mean,
I don't care.
It's not a coincidence that, you know, their Nirvana album is called Nevermind.
Exactly.
I mean, that's
right.
I mean, it's that's summed up. I mean, I don't believe that any one album sums up a generation by any means, but the idea of like Nevermind, it's not even just that I don't care. It's I used to care, but now I don't anymore. So fuck off. You know,
right.
that to me
never
is like
mind.
What Nevermind means. Like, forget it.
And I do think that True TV story, I think, like, encapsulates in a very short time what happened to me later, where I was like, I don't give a shit. And then 3 months later, I was like, well, I need money.
But Generation Y or whatever, millennials and what's Generation Z now, like, they don't feel any embarrassment in promoting themselves on social media.
And they shouldn't. I mean, and I've read critiques from younger people of attitudes like mine, which are dead on, that it's like, it's easy to be like, fuck the system when there is a system.
Yeah.
Like, when there is a path to success. Like, you know, when I was above it all in the 90s, I could get temp jobs. If I wanted to get temp work, it was available to me. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's just...
Yeah.
Whereas now, it's like, there's no money out there. Like, if you, like, oh, I want to work at an office for 2 weeks and then never again.
Yeah.
Like, you can't do that now.
Yeah, you better get a brand for yourself, for real. I mean...
This is one thing I just want to make sure we talk about. So, you were on... So, I saw you at a wedding, like, I think this was, like, 2010? Brian? Okay, you have to go. Brian Olsen's wedding.
Yeah.
And I don't... Was that... So, when was the... Are We There Yet show? Was that you were on that, I think, one I saw you at the wedding.
Probably, yeah. Mm. I would say it was around between 2013 and 2016 or 2012 and 2015. Is a couple over the course of a couple of years.
And that was on TBS?
It was, and then it was syndicated. And so
Terry Crews, right?
Yeah.
Because
we shot 100 of them.
He seems like he's a good dude, I feel like. Terry Crews.
No, he's totally a good dude. I will say he's a very good dude.
Yeah.
And, you know, he wasn't as famous then.
Mm.
He's the only person I've ever met who refers themselves as being blessed, who I truly believe that he believes that. And it's not just a way of bragging without bragging. Because most people, when they say they're blessed, like, oh, I'm just blessed, like, they want to put it on God because really they just want to brag.
Right.
You know what I mean? Whereas he's a guy who just really felt like, oh, my God, you know, because he was an NFL player, and he just had that work ethic. That dude, he had 7 kids, I think 7, and he would wake up every day at like 4:15 in the morning, work out for like an hour and a half or whatever, then go work. He was in almost every scene of every episode of that show, and he would work until like 10 o'clock, and then he would go home and spend some time with his kids, go to bed, and do it all over again every fucking day. I've never seen anybody work as hard as that guy.
What was the process of getting up? Because you were like, were you the like the kind of the white guy on
the
show?
Yeah, I was the white guy. The best friend, dude. It's the role.
Did you do research for that role? Or?
Well, I mean, it's not a coincidence.
Did you watch the Chappelle Show skit to do research?
You know, what's funny is that Ali Leroy, the guy who created it, he had never seen the Chappelle Show sketch, which is I still half don't believe. But he said that he was going through the Comedy Central comedian archive, just looking for comics that he thought would, you know, that he could bring into every audition, and he found me that way. And he said he never saw Chappelle's show, which is bizarre.
Yeah,
to me.
That sounds.
I don't know. I don't know if I believe it, but
he stuck to the story. So what? And did you Ice Cube produced that, right?
Yeah.
So did
he
you?
He was on the show. Sometimes.
He was.
Well, not every episode. He was on. If we shot 100, he was probably on 25 to 30.
And he didn't play the character though. He played in the movie.
No, he played a different. Yeah. He
so
played
did
a
you?
Different character.
What did you interact with? Was that like surreal?
It was very surreal.
Because I mean, we did, you know, we're around the same age, and I remember Ice Cube was just such a huge
you were,
icon.
You were a hip hop dude.
Yeah,
I wasn't, and so, I mean, I will say, He's a very nice guy, but in a Venn diagram of our interests, you know, there's one time I remember where, you know, we're on set and they had to, like, a light was malfunctioning or something. And so we just had to sit there for like an hour and 10 minutes, but they kept thinking that they was almost fixed. So it's not like, hey, go back to your dressing room and we'll call you when we're ready. It's like, no, just give us another minute, guys. And that went on for like over an hour. And so we were just sitting there. And, you know, there's just only so many things I know about the Raiders. You know, like we talked basketball a little bit because I'm a basketball fan. But, you know, and I don't ever got the feeling that he particularly liked me. Not disliked me, but just he just didn't really have much in common, you know.
Yeah.
Alfonso Ribeiro, I definitely feel like, did not like me. He directed like 30 episodes.
Really?
I definitely got the vibe that he didn't like me.
That is Carlton for people who don't know.
Well, I remember he got really mad at me once because I wasn't sexually aggressive enough with Paulina Poroskova.
What?
That's such a weird sentence to say.
I know. Jesus.
You know, I know you're not going to have time to tell that story.
I know.
Okay, do you have to go, right?
I do.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, man.
You'll just have to wonder.
That was great. You'll have to come back. Would you come back?
Absolutely.
I have like a million other things I want to ask you.
Oh, yeah.
We spent way too much time talking about nonsense, and then I didn't even get to Paulina Poroskova.
Before you, so there was a time you were like almost hooking up with Paulina Poroskova.
No, is not an episode where she was playing.
Oh,
like,
she was married.
My like Mrs. Face? Robinson. She was like my older girlfriend, and I didn't like maul her. To his satisfaction, he was like, "I'd be all over her." And I was like, "Yeah, I know, but I don't know her. She's a married woman," and she kind of took it personally. Like she's like, "Oh, it's because I'm old." I'm like, "No, it's
oh, jeez."
Was that the most surreal moment of your life?
It was definitely up there.
That Carlton is yelling at you for not being aggressive with Paulina.
Yeah, for not groping the girl from the Drive video.
Hilarious. Did you have anything quickly that you wanted to?
Yeah, do you
want to promote?
Plug anything?
Yeah, I mean, my latest album is called 60% Choking. You can hear it where you hear music. And comedy and all that jazz. I have a couple of albums that you can pay money now to rent on Amazon and things like that. Mm-hmm. If you are in or around New York City, please come to QED Astoria. It's a performance space that my wife owns in Astoria, Queens, QEDAstoria.com. Oh, and if you're on Twitter, I'm at Christ Finnegan.
Nice.
Boom. Okay, thank you. That was great. Thanks, thanks for coming by.
And, yeah.
Thanks, dudes.
That's the end of this episode. We will see you next time.
Yeah. Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.